I'm fine, yes. Oh, I'm glad. Okay, yeah. Okay, fine. Yeah, Stephen is a good friend of mine.
Oh, neat.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, I just met him last night.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I was here for about 4 or 5 days.
Well, good, good. Praise the Lord. Yeah. Talking about the Roman Empire today. So it really isn't too much related to really Christianity directly as far as the Bible, but it kind of ties in. Interesting. Yeah. Okay, today we're going to continue our discussion on the Roman Empire. And this is going to be the last empire, and then we'll be talking about some other things. We've got a little section on archaeology that's coming up. We also have a little section on the actual geography of Palestine, and we won't be spending a lot of time on that. Maybe, I think, about maybe 3 or 4 hours on that. And we do have a couple more Bible customs to talk about, so we're going to be dealing with those too. So a lot of different things to talk about here in the closing weeks of Bible College. But basically we're talking about the general state of the culture of the Roman Empire and some of the different interesting things that went on in the Roman Empire. And we're talking about those who did not worship the pagan Roman gods and what they were involved in. And basically, amongst the more thoughtful people in the Roman Empire, philosophy took the place of religion. And philosophy was a very big thing in the Roman Empire. We mentioned two different philosophies. The first was Stoicism. And Stoicism held that man's reason was the highest good, and that a person's duty was to live according to this reason that he had in his mind. And so really, man made his mind God. That's always a mistake to do, but man did that. And therefore, the Stoic believed that it was wrong, it was foolish, it was immature, it was childish to live according to your feeling or emotion, or to even express feeling or emotion. So a Stoic never expressed feelings. A Stoic never said, I love you. A Stoic never said, that hurt. That's going by your feelings. You're supposed to go by your rationale. You're supposed to go by your mind. And so the Stoics felt like the body needs to be controlled by the mind. It needs to be denied. In fact, they believed that the body even needed to be ignored. Well, that's definitely an imbalance. You know, that's going too far. Now, he had another opposing ditch, that is the devil did, for others of a different mentality, and that was Epicureanism. It's interesting that if the devil can't get you with one particular philosophy, well, he's got another one that's tailor-made, and they're often just, even though they're juxtaposed side by side, they're often at variance with each other and at opposite ends of the spectrum. Now, Epicureanism held that pleasure was the highest good in life. So therefore, man should make pleasure his pursuit in life. Now, you don't have to prod men to make pleasure their chief god. That comes pretty natural to man, fallen man. Well, what it led to, of course, was many sensual acts, living in the flesh. It led to seeking an absence of pain. Anything that caused pain, you know, you had to relieve the pain somehow. And so the pursuit of pleasure became the chief goal in life. And the Epicureans taught that the body could only be satisfied if the flesh was appeased. And so therefore, if the mind was to know happiness, they satiated their bodies. They did whatever they wanted to do, and it was like, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. That became their motto. That became their standard of living. So you had Stoicism on one side and Epicureanism on the other side. And incidentally, this is why Paul often had such a difficult time dealing with the new converts in areas like Corinth, because they were coming out of this background. The Corinthians came right out of Epicureanism, right out of it. And they had been living this way. They had grown up that way. Their whole culture was that way. And so, you know, they didn't think it was any big thing to come to the Lord's, celebrate the Lord's Supper and get drunk right there when they were celebrating the Lord's Supper and eat their meals right there sumptuously at the Lord's Supper, meanwhile neglecting a poor brother that had nothing to eat, and there was division and there was fighting amongst them, and many of them were living this way. One man in Corinth was living with his own mother and living in an illicit relationship with her. This is the way they've been brought up. And so they came into Christianity, and unfortunately some of these philosophies still clung to them. Now, also, I wanted to say one other thing about emperor worship, because the Romans did worship their emperors. A Roman emperor was normally considered to be a god, and there were actually three ways that an emperor might be worshipped or might come to be considered a god. First of all, the people might just spontaneously start worshipping him. He might be someone like Caesar Augustus. He was a man that commanded the respect of the people. He was a man that was diligent, a good ruler, basically. And so therefore, the people just would spontaneously start worshiping him as a god. And of course, he would not stand up and say, hey, don't do that, because they were full of pride. They would accept it. And once the precedent had been set by a group of people, then the acceptable thing was to join in and worship him as well. In other words, once it got started, then it spread throughout the whole Roman Empire. And resistance could be a very dangerous thing. If you did not go along with it, once it got started, if you did not worship Caesar as God, then all of a sudden you could be ostracized, and it could be very dangerous to your own well-being, your physical life. Now, secondly, an emperor could be worshipped in that he might be declared a deity after he died. Sometime after he had passed away, and later on, he might be worshipped thereafter. Normally, this was done by a vote of the Senate. Normally, the Senate would get together and decide that so-and-so was a god. And they would build temples to him, and often what they would do, they would pull the various cities throughout the Roman Empire, and they would find a certain town that could support with taxes a temple being built, and they would often find one chief town and build a major temple there, and that would become the center of it. And they'd build a big temple there, very extravagant, very beautiful, to this particular Caesar. Now, the third way that an emperor might be worshipped, some emperors appointed themselves as a god. They just appeared and they claimed to be God while they were still alive, obviously. And they claimed to be God and they wanted to be worshipped as God. Now, that was really considered unacceptable by the Romans. They did not really approve of this way as far as the Roman mentality. And in fact, that subjected the emperor to a lot of antagonism and even often murder if they declared this in and of themselves. Normally, the people had to precipitate it, or the Senate had to begin it. And normally, if an emperor began it, like Caligula did and others, then normally that meant their downfall, because they were doing it themselves. Now, of course, emperor worship left the early Christians in a rather awkward position, because they refused to have any part in elevating men as gods. There's no way that a Christian that has understanding from God will ever worship a man as God. I mean, the whole thing is just nauseating. You might respect someone as a brother in the Lord, but that's a big difference between making them a god and respecting them as a brother in the Lord. And so, therefore, they refused to have any part in all this, and yet their disdain for the practice was noticed by the Roman officials, and they were often watching this, and they knew that the Christians did not worship the emperors as gods, and often that put them in poor stead with the Roman authorities. And incidentally, the Romans had no problems with adding new deities to their theology. They did it all the time. They were just like the Egyptians. See, to us, it'd be a massive contradiction. I mean, how can this man become a god? He wasn't even born 50 years ago, and now he's a god? And where did he come from? And so forth. They had no theology, no problems with their theology in this regard. They weren't deep thinkers in this area, and they were very superstitious people, even though they were intelligent and cultured to a degree. And so they just added gods to their theology and to their program all the time. Never had any problems with it. Well, let's talk about the emperors of Rome real briefly. These are not God's stars that are going to shine in the heavens, believe me. First of all, it starts with Julius Caesar. Maybe I should write them down on the board here for you. It might help you with the spelling. A couple are important in that they tie in directly with biblical events. Julius Caesar, who was prominent in the Roman Empire from 100 to 44 B.C. That's the period of time in which he was primarily reigning and exercising political power. He was a brilliant soldier and statesman. He extended the Roman border all the way north to the Rhine River, way up there in the middle of Europe, and all the way west to Britain. And he was a very powerful ruler at this time. However, he was still, before he became a Caesar, he was still under the old republic, which was a form of democracy in which the people and representatives and the Senate were deciding the issues of the political affairs. And with that form of government, it was very, very hard to rule the Roman Empire. And so therefore there was a need to centralize power in one person, and Julius Caesar felt like he was the man, humble person that he was. And so therefore he marched back down to Rome, and I think I mentioned this yesterday, he crossed what was called the River Rubicon. And when the Roman authorities saw him coming, they were afraid of him because they knew that he wanted to be the dictator and destroy the republic. So they commanded that he disband his army. He did not obey them. And he marched into Rome, and he took over Rome and became the dictator of the Roman Empire. And incidentally, that's where we get that statement, what you need to do is cross the River Rubicon. That means an irrevocable decision. And it means something that you cannot alter or go back on. That came from Julius Caesar. Well, Julius was the first person to grab absolute power, and of course he immediately eliminated all of his political rivals, got rid of them, assassinated them, murdered them, which eventually led to his assassination. 3 years later, he was killed. And that brings up a time of great confusion for several years, but out of all the mayhem came another Caesar whose name was Caesar Augustus. Who reigned from 27 BC to AD 14. He was the grandnephew of Julius Caesar, so he was related to him, the grandnephew. He began basically a new government, and he established peace in the Roman Empire. He was able to take the reins over the Roman Empire. He renewed the ancient religious practices. He also rebuilt Rome out of marble. And the real significant thing, though, is the fact that Jesus Christ was born during his reign, during the reign of Caesar Augustus. Little did Caesar know that there was a much greater emperor, a much greater ruler, born in an obscure little town called Bethlehem, several hundred miles across the Mediterranean Ocean, in a little despised land called Palestine. But such it was in the plan of God. And that's found in Luke chapter 2 and verse 1, where it talks about Jesus Christ being born during the time of Caesar Augustus, Luke 2:1. Basically, Augustus imposed no great hardship on the Jews. I don't think he was particularly loved by the Jews. They didn't like the Romans ruling over them, but basically he allowed them to rule themselves, and so forth. Then there was another one called Tiberius. Caesar Tiberius, who reigned from AD 14 to AD 37. He was the adopted son of Augustus. He was a very able administrator. And the real significant thing about Tiberius is the fact that he ruled at the time of Jesus' crucifixion and the origin of the church. The church began under the reign of Tiberius, and Christ was crucified. And incidentally, Pontius Pilate was directly underneath the authority of Tiberius, directly. The Jewish procurators, like Pontius Pilate and Felix and Festus, the others that are mentioned in the book of Acts, they were directly responsible to the Roman emperor himself. They went right to him, and because they were put on hot spots, and Palestine was a hot spot. And so technically, really, Pilate could have appealed to Tiberius, and Tiberius could have just overruled the whole thing if he would have wanted to. But Pilate did not do that. Then there's another one called Caesar Caligula. Caligula. He was a madman, i.e. crazy, i.e. demon-possessed. As several of these emperors may have had a real problem with demon possession, the pride was just tremendous in their hearts. Caligula, that's spelled C-A-L-I-G-U-L-A, reigned from A.D. 37 to A.D. 41, only about maybe 4 years there. He was elevated to the throne by the Senate and immediately demanded to be worshipped as God as soon as he was elevated. A very arrogant man, filled with the devil, filled with pride. In fact, just to show you how mad he really was, as a madman, he once installed a horse as an official in his government and made him, you know, one of his counselors, a horse. Made him an official in his government. The big blow to him, as far as the Jews were concerned, he came down into Palestine and he ordered that a statue of himself be placed in the temple of Jerusalem in the Holy of Holies. And of course, you know what that'd be as far as trying to bring peace to Palestine. The Jews resented that. And there's no way. In fact, they told the Romans that you're going to do this over our dead bodies. That's exactly what they told the Romans. And fortunately for the Romans during that time, he was assassinated before he carried out his plan. And he never did put a statue of himself in the temple. But the Romans meant that, or the Jews meant that, when they said that they would fight to the death. That's exactly what they would do for their religion. And the Romans would have had their hands full with them because the Jews were really feisty people. And then there was another one called Claudius. And he reigned from A.D. 41 to 54. I'm just saying just maybe one or two main points about each one of them. Caesar Claudius, C-L-A-U-D-I-U-S, reigned from A.D. 41 to A.D. 54. Physically, he was incompetent. Physically, he had some physical handicaps. But he was a scholar. He was a learned man. And he did something that was a little bit different than the other Caesars. He organized a bureaucracy to rule over the Roman Empire, and he used his freedmen. Now, a freedman was a person that was a slave but was set free. So he used former slaves, and he made friends with a number of them, and he was basically somewhat popular with a number of these people under him, which was kind of a change of events, because often a Caesar was in power only because he had power and not because he was popular. The significant thing about him as far as Bible history is that he expelled the Jews from the city of Rome, and you can read about that in Acts chapter 18 and verse 2, Acts 18:2. Well, then that brings us to another very, very infamous emperor. His name was Nero, N-E-R-O, Nero, yes. No, the Jews. Yeah, the Jews from Rome. Yes. Yeah, there were Jews that were living there. In fact, that's where, what are their names in Acts chapter 18? The couple that worked with the Apostle Paul, Aquila, Priscilla. Yes, see, they were expelled from Rome because they were Jews. Now, they were believers, but they were Jewish believers. And they were expelled from Rome and worked with Paul. And the reason that he expelled them is because the Jews had a penchant for fighting, and particularly with the Christians that were starting there, and it was kind of upsetting to him that they were fighting like that in Rome, so he kicked them out of town, anyone that was a Jew. Then we come to Nero, and Nero reigned from A.D. 54 to A.D. 68. A.D. 54 to A.D. 68. He gave Rome a fairly able administration for the first 5 years of his leadership, but then after that, he became, I think, probably demon-possessed. He was morally unscrupulous. He murdered his own mother. He could not be trusted. He murdered people left and right. He was insane. And then eventually what he did is he burned down Rome. And the reason why, he wanted to rebuild it again in all the splendor of early Rome. And, of course, he wanted to put his name on all the cornerstones of the new buildings. And so he burned down Rome. That made him very unpopular, obviously, with the Romans. And so he had to put the blame on someone else. So he blamed the Christians. And they were a very convenient scapegoat because they were always talking about the lake of fire, and they were always talking about the fact that if you reject God, you're going to burn forever. And they talked about the fact that this heavens and this earth are going to be destroyed with a fervent heat. And they talked about the fire, and so he blamed them. And Nero had many Christians arrested. He tortured many of them. He even burned them alive. And he did that partly to divert attention from his own political problems. For example, the burning of Rome. But also he did it to amuse himself. This is how he found his pleasure, is by torturing Christians. And he had a real penchant to do this. In fact, let me read to you a quote from Miller's Church History. And this is page 122, Miller's Church History book. And they say concerning Nero, quote, "This was the first legal persecution of the Christians, and in some of its features it stands alone in the annals of human barbarity. Inventive cruelty sought out new ways of torture to satiate the bloodthirsty Nero, the most cruel emperor that ever reigned. The gentle, peaceful, unoffending followers of the Lord Jesus were sewn in the skins of wild beasts and torn by dogs." In other words, they would throw them into the Colosseum when they were covered with these skins, and of course the wild dogs would tear them to pieces. "Others were wrapped in a kind of dress smeared with wax and with tar and pitch and other combustible matter, and with a stake under the chin to keep them upright, and set on fire when the day closed, that they might serve as lights in the public gardens of popular amusements." So in other words, Christians became torches. And when the Romans would go and When they go to their amusement parks, guess who was burning there and lighting up the park? Christians were. It says Nero lent his own gardens for these exhibitions and gave entertainments for the people. He took an active part in the games himself, sometimes mingling with the crowd on foot, sometimes viewing the awful spectacle from his chariot. But accustomed as these people were to public executions and gladiatorial shows, they were moved to pity by the unexampled suffering on the part of the Christians. So even though the Romans had seen all this gore in the gladiator fights and people hacking each other up, that was common fare for the Romans. When they saw how Nero treated the Christians, they were filled with pity for the Christians. Now, it must have been bad. And it goes on and says, they began to see that they suffered not for the public good, but to gratify the cruelty of one man. But fearful as their death was, it was soon over, and to them, no doubt, the happiest moment of their existence. Long, long before the lights were quenched in Nero's garden, the martyrs had found their home and rest above in the blooming garden of God's eternal delights. The precious truth we learn from what the Savior said to the penitent thief on the cross, today shalt thou be with me in paradise. So it was a real serious time for the Christians, and yet by the same token, it was really a one-way ticket to heaven, really what Nero was really doing. Well, I could talk about others, but I don't think I'm going to take the time to talk about some of the later ones because they don't really tie in directly to Bible history. But suffice it to say, there were other Roman emperors and so forth that reigned over the Roman Empire. It lasted all the way until AD 476, and they had several dozen other emperors that reigned over them. Some of them were, you know, okay as far as persecution was concerned. Others were relentless. Others were just filled with the devil so much they had only one thing in mind, and that was to kill every Christian on the face of the earth, and so the Christians had to retreat to the catacombs. Now, let's talk about the Roman government in the land of Palestine for a few moments now. The Roman government in Judea and Palestine. The expanding Roman Empire devoured Judea in 63 B.C. In other words, the Romans came down, took over Palestine in 63 B.C. That is about 60 years before Jesus was born. There was a Roman general. His name was Pompey. Powerful general. And it was basically Pompey that led the forces down into Palestine, P-O-M-P-E-Y. He led the Roman forces into the city of Jerusalem, and he actually overcame the Jews, obviously, just overpowered them, crushed them. But he also angered many of the Jews. He was a very insensitive man, and he had a number of ruthless tactics. For example, he took a large number of the priests and murdered them in cold blood while they were actually ministering in the temple. And then also, he had the audacity to enter into the Jewish Holy of Holies, just marched, walked right into it, and that upset the Jews, and the Jews were outraged with the Romans right at the outset. And so these early atrocities and insensitivities on the part of the Romans set in motion hostility and friction, which continued for the entire period of time that the Romans reigned over Palestine. The Jews hated the Romans. They despised the Romans. Most of them did. They had nothing but hatred, basically, for them. Even the people that were religious and spiritual, they probably would have annihilated the Romans. They could not stand them. Now, furthermore, the Romans knew that they couldn't instantly just start reigning over Palestine, so they took a Jewish king and made him king over Palestine, but he was totally loyal to Rome. His name was Herod the Great. Herod the Great. And he was really an infamous king of Israel. The Israelites did not like him either. He was placed on the throne by the Romans, and he bowed to every Roman whim. Whatever the Romans wanted, Herod the Great made sure that they got. And so that made him basically unpopular with most of the Jews. At this time, Palestine was divided into five sub-areas, and the Romans ruled over all five of these areas. And actually, Herod the Great initially ruled over all five areas. And these are kind of like little mini-states. One was called Judea. That's where Jesus ministered often. Jesus was born in Judea. And then the other was called Samaria. And then another was called Galilee. And then there were two others called Perea and Trachonitis. Maybe I should write those in. Judea, Samaria, Galilee, Perea, and Trachonitis. And Herod the Great ruled over all of these. So if you look at a map, it kind of looks like this. Let's find a map of
Palestine and New Testament time, too. Galilee is up here to the north. Samaria is right in the heart of Palestine. Judea is in the southern portion of Palestine. And then Trachonitis is up over here in the area of Decapolis. And then Perea was the southern portion on this side of Palestine. Five distinct areas. Herod the Great ruled over all five of those areas. He was very jealous of his position, Herod the Great was. And so he therefore ruthlessly murdered anyone that might oppose him, anyone that might threaten his position, that might jeopardize his position. And so therefore he murdered several members of his own immediate family. He was afraid that they might somehow take over his rulership. And so therefore Jesus was born under his rulership. And the Jews were saying, the King of the Jews is born. Well, Herod the Great got wind of that and felt like this young lad's going to grow up and he's going to become the king. He's going to take the land away from me. And so he instantly ordered that that Jesus be killed. And of course, when the wise men did not tell him the location of Jesus, he commanded everyone 2 years old and younger be killed in this particular locality. You can read about that in Matthew chapter 2. Matthew chapter 2, he was a powerful ruler, an able administrator, cleared Palestine of robbers and criminals. That was about the only good thing he did. And another thing that he did, he tried to appease the Jews by rebuilding their temple for them. And this was the temple that had been built by Zerubbabel way back in 536 B.C., I believe, when the Jews came back from Babylon. They had rebuilt this temple. And so it was several hundred years old. Herod the Great remodeled it for them, and he took 46 years to rebuild it. And actually more than 46 years, really. Jesus said 40 and 6 years has this temple been in building, and that was during, I should say the Jews said that, I guess, to Jesus. But that was during the time of Jesus, and he kept building it after the death of Jesus as well. And it was something to behold. It was incredible the way he built that up. And he basically did that to somehow pacify the Jews and to gain their favor, which he never fully did. And then after the death of Herod the Great, Judea was administered as a province. The Romans were able to slip in their own men now, and they actually put in charge... Well, where should I write this down? Maybe you erase this right here. They put in charge over the province what was called a procurator. And the procurator was directly responsible to the Roman emperor. So basically over Judea, they put a procurator. Now Herod's sons reigned over the other four provinces, but over Judea there was a procurator put. That's spelled P-R-O-U or P-R-O-C-U-R-A-T-O-R. And this was actually a Roman official. For example, like Pontius Pilate. Pontius Pilate was a procurator. He was a Roman that was put over Judea. And then also in the book of Acts, when you read about Felix and Festus, they were Roman procurators that Paul had to stand before. Yes, Lewis.
Was this after
Herod's death? Yes. Right. When Herod died, then all of a sudden, of course, his office was vacated. And so what the Romans did is they took Judea and they made it a province, and they put a procurator over Judea, and then Herod's other sons reigned over the other provinces. And so that's why you'll read about other Herods in the Bible. There's actually several Herods mentioned in the Bible. There's one Herod called Herod Antipas, who is different than Herod the Great. There's another one called Herod Agrippa the First. And so when you read the New Testament, just realize there's several Herods that are mentioned. And the other Herods, the later ones, are sons of Herod the Great, ruling over the other provinces. Yes?
So five areas turned into provinces?
Actually, just one of them did. It was Judea. and the other four remained pretty much the same way that they had been before, but Herod's sons reigned over those. And I think he had like three sons, and one of them took like two of the other areas, and then the other two took, you know, one apiece or something like that. But you'll read about several Herods in the Bible, and they're different than Herod the Great. They're descendants or sons of Herod. So the final point about all this, as far as the Romans occupying the land of Palestine, is this, is that the Israel into which Jesus Christ was born was a very oppressive pagan power. There was a real cloud of oppression that hung over Palestine. Many of the Jewish authorities, in fact, that were really had Jewish blood in them, actually retained their positions by seeking to please the Romans, so there was a lot of compromise there. And often offices were acquired and maintained by bribery and extortion, so there was a lot of bribery, there was a lot of extortion, there were a lot of Jewish officials that were compromising with the Romans, and all those conditions are really important to consider when you study the life and the ministry and the death of Jesus, because they all play a part in the picture. Now let's talk about something else real briefly here. Let's talk briefly about Roman citizenship. Roman citizenship. Very, very important facet of living in the Roman Empire. The policy of Rome was to make good Romans out of its new subjects. And so the Roman Empire actually held out the offer of Roman citizenship to many people if they would meet certain qualifications. Basically, the policy of Rome was when they conquered an area, they basically sought to allow the people to rule themselves as much as possible to gain the favor of the people. So they came down and they conquered Palestine, for example. They basically allowed the Jews to rule themselves. As long as they were basically submissive, and as long as they did not rebel against Rome, and as long as they paid their taxes, and as long as they supported the troops that were stationed in Palestine, they basically were allowed to rule themselves in most areas. And often what the Romans would do, as a further incentive, they would extend to these other conquered areas citizenship. Now, citizenship did not come easily. There were a number of things involved in it. When the Romans came down and conquered you, you basically became a slave to the Roman Empire. That's how it started off. Now, they may have left you in your home country, but that didn't make you a citizen. So you basically did not have any rights in this new country that had just conquered you. So you were now a member of the Roman Empire, but without any rights. You were kind of like a slave. And then they took a certain portion of the population and they shipped them back to Rome and they sold them on the slave market. They took the choicest men, the women, they took the people that were talented, the people that had education, they took the doctors, they took the learned teachers, and they shipped them back to Rome. And of course you didn't volunteer for this, and you went back to Rome and you were a slave and you had no rights as a slave. Now it was possible to obtain Roman citizenship by a number of different avenues. Number one, you could obtain citizenship by reward for services. If you served the Roman Empire, for example, if you joined one of the foreign legions, joined the Roman army, and if you served for a certain amount of years as a faithful Roman soldier in one of the foreign legions, then they would grant you citizenship after you had served for a number of years. And I'm not sure how long you had to serve. It may have varied from locality to locality or situation to situation. But for an allotted period of time, you served in the Roman army or some other service to the Roman Empire, and they would grant you citizenship. Another way you could get it was simply by freedom after a period of slavery. Sometimes you were sold as a slave for a certain period of time, like maybe 5 or 10 years. And at the end of the allotted time, you were set free and you were made a citizen. And that wasn't a real common way, though. Normally what happened, you were sold as a slave, you lived as a slave, and you died as a slave. And there was never any hope for you, really. The third way of obtaining citizenship was by purchasing it with a sum of money. If you were a wealthy person, you could purchase your citizenship from the Romans for a certain amount of money. But the problem is that normally if you were conquered, you were poor, and normally you didn't have the money to purchase citizenship. And then the final way to receive citizenship was by birth from your parents. If your parents were citizens, then instantly when you were born, you were a citizen. So, in fact, that's probably what happened to the Apostle Paul. Paul evidently was born a Roman citizen, and his parents were citizens, see? And so instantly when Paul was born, that made him a Roman citizen. Now, what is the real significance of being a Roman citizen? Well, there were several benefits. Now, first of all, if you weren't a citizen and you were a slave, you were not considered a person by the Romans. You had no rights. None. None. I mean absolutely none if you were a slave. And in fact, if you were a slave, you were a thing, not a person. And you had no legal rights. There was no such thing as justice where a slave was involved. Your master could do anything he wanted to with you. If you were a male or a female slave, the power of the Roman master was absolute over you. If he wanted to kill you in cold blood and feed you to the dogs, no one would wince. He could do it. He could do anything he wanted with you. He could take you down and sell you. He could trade you for someone else. He could beat you. He could do anything he wanted. So you were totally at the beck of this Roman master over you. In fact, the Roman law was so stringent that they had the death penalty for any slave that ran away. If you ran away from your master, and if you were caught, it was a death penalty for you. Or if you ever rebelled against your master and struck your master, the Roman law mandated that you could be killed and your entire family with you. And very often that was the situation. So there was no real recourse for you. You were just a thing. The famous historian Will Durant once said about Roman citizenship, quote, "Never before or since has citizenship been so jealously guarded or so highly prized," end quote. You can imagine why. If all of a sudden you weren't a Roman citizen and you became a slave and you had no money, that was it. That was going to be your lifestyle. And fortunately for you, you'd be blessed if you had a good master. But if you ended up with some rascal, some guy that was demon-possessed or something, that beat you all the time, you had no recourse. Now, another benefit of citizenship, it gave you the right to vote to a certain degree. Apparently, I think this had basically, during the emperorships and so forth, I think it referred basically to local affairs, that you could vote as far as local affairs were concerned. I'm not sure to what extent nationally that had an impact. But then thirdly, Roman citizenship protected you. You see, a Roman citizen could not be bound. He could not be imprisoned without a trial. Very similar to, for example, let's say American law right now. You can't just take someone and throw them into prison for X amount of years without trying them. You can detain them in jail for so long until, you know, the crimes are written up or whatever, but you can't just take someone and throw them into jail. That's the way it was during the Roman Empire. And furthermore, they would not scourge you. And this was a very common Roman custom, and that's basically like this. Let's say something was stolen, and there were like four people that may have been indicted for this crime of stealing something. They would take all four people, and if they weren't Roman citizens, they would beat them and torture them until someone confessed. And that's what they did. Whenever they wanted to get some type of confession from you, if you weren't a Roman citizen, they scourged you. They tied you to a pillar, and they took a Roman soldier, and he beat you. And he beat you and beat you and beat you until you confessed. And you could never appeal to anyone. You had no recourse. But if you're a Roman citizen, they could not scourge you. And in fact, if anyone did scourge you, and if you were a Roman citizen, they would get in big, big trouble. In fact, I'd like to read a couple passages to you concerning the Apostle Paul. Let's turn to Acts chapter 16. Notice what Paul did. It's a good thing that Paul was a Roman citizen because he ministered in areas and in ways that other people were not able to minister. He went places where Peter and James and John could not go because John and Peter and the others were not Roman citizens, evidently. And so therefore, Paul took full advantage of his Roman citizenship. Now, you know the account in Romans chapter 16. He's ministering Acts chapter 16. I'm sorry. Acts chapter 16. Paul was ministering in the city of Philippi there. And as he was ministering, the Roman authorities came down and they arrested him and they threw him in prison. And that was totally against Roman law because Paul was a Roman citizen. They threw him in prison and they beat him without any trial. And evidently, it was such a mob rule and it was such a riot that had broken out that the Roman authorities had not taken the time to ask Paul about his background. They just assumed that he was not a Roman citizen. Well, the officials of this city that were responsible for this could have gotten into big, big trouble. Not only would they be removed from their offices, but they themselves would be beaten, and they themselves would end up in prison. So notice what happens here down in verse 35. And when it was day, the magistrates sent the sergeants, saying, "Let those men go. We don't have any real reason to detain them. They haven't really done anything wrong. Let Paul and Silas go." Here are the Roman authorities. And so it says in verse 36, "And the keeper of the prison told this saying to Paul, 'The magistrates have sent to let you go. Now therefore depart and go in peace.'" Verse 37, "But Paul said unto them, 'They have beaten us openly, uncondemned, being Romans.'" Paul is saying, "I am a Roman citizen as well as Silas, and we are uncondemned, and they scourged us. That was against Roman law. And now do they thrust us out privily or privately? Nay, verily, but let them come themselves and fetch us out." So what Paul was demanding is that these Roman authorities responsible for this, that they personally come and they open up the jail door and let Paul out, or release Paul. I guess Paul was already out of jail now, but release Paul and let Paul go free, see, from this Roman confinement. It says in verse 38, "And the sergeants told these words unto the magistrates, and they feared when they heard that they were Romans. And they came and besought them and brought them out and desired them to depart out of the city." In other words, Paul and Silas are hot potatoes now, and they want to get rid of them, and they want them to kind of sneak out the back way now and kind of pretend like this whole thing didn't happen. And now they're dealing with Paul a lot differently. And verse 40, it says, or verse 39, or verse 40, I guess, "And they went out of the prison and entered into the house of Lydia, and when they had seen the brethren, they comforted them and departed." So the authorities changed a lot when they found out Paul was a Roman citizen. And then look at chapter 22, verse 24. Chapter 22, verse 24 here. This is where Paul was arrested by the Roman authorities again. And this time it was for the riot that had erupted over Paul being in the temple, being accused of taking a Gentile in the temple. And the Roman authorities apprehend him, and they're taking him away to confinement. And look at chapter 22, verse 24. "And the chief captain commanded him to be brought into the castle." That was a Roman fortress connected to the Jewish temple. "And they bade that he should be examined by scourging, that he might know whereof they cried so against him." In other words, the Roman policy was just to beat Paul until he confessed to what he had done wrong, to get the truth from him. And verse 25, "And as they bound him with thongs," now that already was against Roman law. They were not supposed to do that. "So they bound him with thongs. Paul said on the centurion that stood by, 'Is it lawful for you to scourge a man that is a Roman and uncondemned?'" Now notice the response of the Roman. "When the centurion heard that, he went and told the chief captain, saying, 'Take heed what you're doing, for this man is a Roman. He's a Roman citizen.' Then the chief captain came and said unto him, 'Tell me, are you a Roman?' He said, 'Yea.'" And there's no way that they would lie about their Roman citizenship, because it was the death penalty for lying about that as well. And they had records back in the town that you claim to be from that proved whether you were a citizen or not, and they could easily check up on you. So people did not lie about their Roman citizenship. Verse 27, or verse 28. "And the chief captain answered, 'With a great sum obtained I this freedom.' And Paul said, 'But I was freeborn.'" So the very people that were going to beat him, this one Roman official said, "Now I purchased my citizenship. There was a time when I wasn't even a citizen. I purchased mine." And Paul had one up on him. He was born a citizen. And that was kind of like a notch higher in the Roman mind. And it says in verse 29, "Then straightway they departed from him, which should have examined him. And the chief captain also was afraid, after he knew that he was a Roman, and because he had bound him." Paul could have actually pressed charges right there and actually gotten these Roman authorities into trouble. Paul did not do that, though. He made them sweat a little bit, but he did not press charges. Just like back in Acts chapter 16, Paul did not press charges either there when he could have done that against those authorities. Yes? I'm sure he had a basic understanding of his rights. Yes. In fact, later on, remember now, when he was being tried by Festus and Felix, and the Jews were accusing him of a crime, and I think it was one of them, I can't remember if it was Felix or Festus, said, "Paul, will you go up to Jerusalem and be tried?" And Paul said, "I stand before Caesar, and Caesar will judge me." And you know what they had to do? They had to ship Paul all the way to Rome, because Roman law was such that if you were under an unjust court system
in which they were not properly dealing with you, you could appeal to Caesar himself, and the authorities were required by Roman law to ship you all the way back to Rome, where you would stand before Caesar himself, and Caesar himself would judge your case. And that's what Paul did. And when that happened, they had to ship Paul over. They had to guard him. They had to keep him safe, protect him from anyone. Otherwise, you know, they could have gotten in great trouble themselves. And Paul went all the way to Rome. So he understood his rights as a Roman, and he used them too, and to his advantage. Well, let's talk about another point here. We've got only a few more things to say about the Roman Empire. Another point is tax collection. Boy, talk about a pet peeve amongst the Jews. It was this tax collection. You feel like the IRS bugs you. You should have been a Jew in Palestine during this time. Because the Roman Empire, they were oppressive as far as taxes were concerned. It was a huge empire. They were squandering their public monies on all kinds of things that were not really prudent. The Roman Empire required huge sums of money to finance all of its functions, all of its highways, all of its amphitheaters, all of its public holidays, you know, 93 of them. The government footed the bill for all the coliseums and all the activities, and all the harbors and all the armies that the Romans had, that cost a lot of money. And you know where they got it from? All these conquered nations. That's where they got the taxes from, as well as the Roman nation itself. And so what the Romans did then, they instituted what was called the franchise system of tax collection. Very interesting way, very lucrative way, a way that preys on the egotism of man, really. The franchise system for tax collection, in fact, by the time of Jesus, it had been in operation for some 200 years and had served the Romans very well. However, it did not serve the local citizen near as well because it was a very oppressive thing for him. But here's how it worked. With the franchise method, what they'd do is they would allow a tax collector, if you were willing to be one, they would allow a tax collector to purchase an area or jurisdiction from the Romans. And these tax collectors would purchase an actual area. For example, like maybe a tax collector would purchase the city of Jerusalem from the Romans. And what the Romans would say, they would tell this tax collector, now we demand from you that you get $100,000 from this city every year, and we don't care how you get it. And our Roman troops will stand behind you to make sure you get it. And so basically it was up to the discretion of the tax collector to get the money. He was under contract by the Roman authorities, and often the contract had a duration of several years, and it just simply specified a quota which the collector was to fulfill every single year and give to the government. And so the purchaser of the franchise, in turn now, he had to make a profit, didn't he? Because he's the tax collector. So what he did, he took his jurisdiction, and he said, okay, I need $100,000 from this area, but I need to make my income, so I'm going to get $150,000. And he would collect $50,000 more, and the Romans shrugged their shoulders. They did not care how much more he collected above and beyond the quota. That was his discretion. And, of course, you had to be prudent. You couldn't charge too much, or you wouldn't be a tax collector any longer. So you had to kind of strike a happy balance. But really, how much he collected depended on two things, his conscience and his ingenuity. And most of their consciences were seared, and most of them were extremely ingenious, and most of them were able to obtain a lot of money. And very often, they would accept bribes from very rich men, and rich men would bribe them. And so to make up for the money that they didn't collect from the rich man, they would take money from poor people. And they would oppress the poor, and the poor were greatly oppressed. And meanwhile, the rich were bribing them all the time, left and right. Now, in addition to all this, in addition to all the Roman taxes, which were very, very high, very oppressive, there was a man called Herod the Great. I talked about him. He had his own tax system. And he was also a man, he had a great appetite for buildings to somehow pacify all of his building desires and all of his lavish ornaments. So he had oppressive taxes. And he was demanding taxes from the Jews. And furthermore, the temple service demanded taxes. In other words, the Lord demanded a tithe from the people. So they were taxed to the hilt. I mean, they were barely able to live because of all this tax collection. Now, how do you think the tax collectors were viewed by the general public? Well, I'll tell you, they were hated. More often than not, what the Romans did is that they offered this calling to the Jews. And so one of the Jews would become a turncoat and become a tax collector. So what you had to forfeit your reputation for wealth.
really is what it came down to. You had to be willing to be the most unpopular person on the face of the earth. It was kind of like if Adolf Hitler was to walk down the streets of Jerusalem now, that's about how popular you would be if you were a tax collector in Palestine. They hated you. They despised you. You represented the Roman authority. You took away their money. They didn't like parting with their money the way it was. They didn't have enough food for their daily living. And the tax collectors were everywhere. They were on all the Roman roads. Every single road built by the Romans had tax collectors on it. And every single year you had to pay your taxes to the Romans. And they despised them. And it's interesting that when Jesus began his ministry, you know who he began to minister to? He often ministered to the tax collectors. And in fact, one of the first apostles he called was Matthew, who was sitting as a tax collector. And Jesus went up and ministered to that man and poured out the love of God to him. And then you know what happened? Matthew became a follower of Jesus Christ. And not only that, Matthew responded by serving a feast at his home, and his fellow tax collectors came to the feast. That's probably the only ones that would come into his house, another tax collector. And Jesus came and ate a meal with them. And that kind of be like going over and eating with the, you know, the Russian Politburo or something like that, Gorbachev and all the others. I mean, and so therefore, there was a lot of strong public rebuke and resentment for the way Jesus was treating these tax collectors. They didn't like this because he was eating with men like this, but he was winning them to the Lord, and that was the real key thing. Well, let me tell you about the fall of Rome. That's the last point here that I'm going to mention. The fall of Rome. It's interesting, it actually fell in AD 476. It lasted a long time. It was the longest of all the ancient world empires. In 1787, a man called Edward Gibbon, after 20 years of labor, wrote a monumental book. It was called The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. And he basically attributed the fall of the Roman Empire to five distinct things. And it's interesting, now this was written back in 1787. Compare this to what is happening right now in America. Let me read them to you. Number one, he said, the rapid increase of divorce, the undermining of the dignity and sanctity of the home, which is the basis of all human society. That was number one. That was one element that caused the Roman Empire to fall. The family was undermined. Marriages were undermined. As an institution, it was no longer sacred. Number two, higher and higher taxes, and the spending of public money for free bread and circuses for the populace. So the Roman government was charging more and more taxes and taking the money and buying free bread, doling out free bread, and also spending a lot of the money for the circuses. Are these things starting to kind of fit a little bit with America? Number three, the mad craze for pleasure, sports becoming every year more exciting and more brutal. Sports becoming a craze, a pleasure, every year being more exciting and more brutal. Doesn't that ring a bell? In my opinion, this has gotten way out of hand in America. Now, I'm not against sports, but when you take these athletes and pay them as much money as they are paid, four times in one year what the president is paid, some guy that can, you know, he's 7 foot tall and he can put a ball through a basketball hoop, and he gets paid, he's getting paid much more than he's worth to society, much more, in my opinion. He may be a good athlete, but he's not worth $1 million a year, and no one's worth that much in that area. Imagine how the angels feel when they look down from heaven and look down at man's activities here in America, and they're watching 60,000 people who are paying $900,000 to sit in a stadium that cost $45 million to watch 22 players who are paid $7 million a year to dispute over a ball that costs $16.95. How do you think the angels feel? Does it make any sense? I'm not against football, per se, although I think it's too violent myself. But how would the angels feel? Well, this has become a big thing in America. I mean, you're kicking a golden calf right in the side now when you start talking about this. Now, number four, he listed number four, and these are actual quotes right from his book. I've got italics here. Number four, the building of gigantic armaments when the real enemy was within the decadence of the people. The building of gigantic armaments. You know, we've got to have our missiles and everything, and I agree we have to have a strong defense, but the real enemy is not the Russians. The real enemy really is the heart of the Americans that are living in sin. Really, that's our real enemy. And I wish the politicians would expose that enemy, because that's public enemy number one, the hearts of the Americans themselves. Well, I don't have time for the other one. I have to mention it next week, but it's the decay of religion. That's number five. Those all fit, don't they? They all fit almost to a T, really, to right where America is right now. Okay. We'll have to talk about this next week. Okay, so have a good weekend. Tell them that you want some ice cream.
I'll tell them I want lots of ice cream. Take a minute, you go
through
all that.
That used to be the big thing when I was a kid. They take your tonsils out. The only consolation is they will give you ice cream. Do they still tell you that?
Yep, they still tell you that.
Oh, they do.
Popsicles too, but who's going to feel like eating after all that?
Well, I hope you feel better.